From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
Our roads are bad. Our schools are bad. Our highways, our tunnels, our bridges. Our bridges are falling down. You see those reports. They're dangerous, many of them. So we're going to get our infrastructure taken care of.
We'll continue our look at Donald Trump's cabinet picks. Today, transportation. What could Trump's selection of Elaine Chao mean for Massachusetts roads, bridges, and tunnels? Also, a Harvard Business School professor on why top business executives commit white-collar crimes.
Oftentimes, the people that are perpetrating these acts have little or no emotion at the time that what they're doing is actually sinister, guilt, or feeling that they're actually doing anything that harmful.
And we celebrate an award-winning local librarian in the Berkshires.
In this small public library, as a solo librarian, I get to do everything, and I love that.
It's Radio Boston, First the News.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We've been taking a close look at President-elect Donald Trump's new cabinet as it takes shape and asking what impact his picks might have on Massachusetts. A little later this hour, we'll hear from former Massachusetts Transportation Secretary Richard Davey about what he makes of Trump's pick for federal transportation secretary. But first, let's take an even closer look at health. Trump has nominated Obamacare supercritic Tom Price for Secretary of Health and Human Services. Yesterday, we spoke with Stuart Altman, chair of the Mass Health Policy Commission.
That $1 trillion of new money that was spent on the Affordable Care Act went to support every hospital and doctor in this country. And if that gets pulled back or a substantial amount of it goes away, it's going to have implications not only for the people in these programs, but for everyone in America.
Well, we want to dig down to an even deeper level of detail on the relationship that Massachusetts has with the federal Department of Health and Human Services. So joining us now is Judy Ann Bigby. From 2007 to 2013, she was the Massachusetts Secretary of Health and Human Services. She's now a senior fellow at Mathematica Policy Research, a Cambridge-based nonpartisan social policy research organization, and she joins us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much.
So we're really taking advantage of this opportunity as the president-elect shapes his cabinet to understand at a much more detailed level what the relationship is between these federal departments and what goes on here in Massachusetts. So with that in mind, my first couple of questions are sort of context-setting questions here, right? Like, I was looking at the fiscal 17 budget for Massachusetts, $39 billion budget overall. The Department of Health and Human Services in the state, its budget is $21 billion, so 54% of what we spend in Massachusetts are on these services. So given that, I mean, how would you characterize the importance of, for the state, of who gets picked up for the federal Health and Human Services Secretary?
Well, first I want to emphasize that for most of the services developed, supplied by, paid for in Health and Human Services, there's a federal contribution to the state, and the state makes its own contribution. So that budget that you just articulated for Health and Human Services, somewhere probably about half of that actually comes from federal funds. So it's a longstanding partnership, which mostly is defined by the fact that the Medicaid program is a federal-state partnership. So it's very important to Massachusetts that people recognize that and understand that department touches just about everybody's life.
I mean, so another way of putting it is a quarter of the state's budget overall is then coming from federal dollars.
Well, I you know, some estimate around
there. Around there. So a not insignificant portion. Then.
Yeah, I mean, it's not only Medicaid, it's child welfare services, it's public health. There are other things as well.
Okay, so then tell me, how would you describe what the relationship is then beyond the dollars or the importance of the relationship between the federal and the state departments of Health and Human Services?
So the state basically takes the framework that the federal government sets up to figure out how to best serve the population in Massachusetts. And Within that framework, states have some flexibility about the type of services they provide, who they cover, and how they are designed.
Mm-hmm. So one of the main examples of that then would be the Medicaid waiver that Massachusetts has.
Well, the Medicaid program in general.
In general.
And definitely specifically the Medicaid waiver is the way that Massachusetts gets to take the federal framework and say, well, this is how we're going to deliver it in Massachusetts. Mm.
And right now, they just recently received another 5-year waiver, the state did, and part of that waiver includes trying to do some innovations for accountable care organizations, things like that in the state?
Correct. So the waiver, which Massachusetts has had for a couple of decades, is a vehicle by which the state can say to federal HHS, we want to do some different things with our Medicaid program. Here are the things we'd like to achieve. The federal government wants to make sure that there are adequate protections for people who will be enrolled in Medicaid and that there will be what is called budget neutrality so that these innovations that the state tries won't cost the federal government any more than if they just did a plain vanilla Medicaid program as the federal government.
I see. So it gives gives states room to innovate as long as they don't spend a dollar more.
Yes, as long as there's what is called budget neutrality.
Right. Go ahead.
And the current Massachusetts waiver is a 5-year one that builds on previous waivers, but has an important innovation in the way the Medicaid delivery system is designed, so that instead of there being silos of different types of providers and payments for different types of providers, there's more integration and you have an accountable entity who says, we will make sure that this population of Medicaid enrollees that we're going to care for gets high quality care at the most in the most efficient way, and that we can demonstrate that the outcomes are good.
So, Judy Ann Bigby, let me ask you: for 6 years, you were the Commonwealth Secretary for Health and Human Services. You oversaw MassHealth. Are you concerned that the things that Donald Trump has said on the campaign trail, his desire to repeal and possibly replace Obamacare? I mean, could that have an imperiling impact? I'm making up words here, but an impact on our state's healthcare reform law?
Well, I think it's that's a very broad question and hard to speculate, but I think it's important to remember that the Massachusetts health care reform law passed in 2006. It also involved working with a Republican administration to make the Medicaid aspect of that part work, and it's our state law to have this reform that allowed Massachusetts to achieve about a 2-3% uninsured rate. That law will still be in effect, and I think it remains to be seen what kind of impact it might have. Mm. But Massachusetts has its own law to keep the ship sailing.
Right. Well, I mean, we have the state law that has to be honored to the best of its ability, but if so much of that law is dependent on the rules within Medicaid, then is that an area? If you were secretary, the Commonwealth Secretary today, is that a place that you would be looking to as with potential concern?
I think with any new administration, you want to know what kind of policies will change and what impact it has on what's already in place and what you plan for in terms of innovations and improvements. And Medicaid is an important part of that.
Well, the Department of Health and Human Services in this state covers so much. I mean, MassHealth is a major part of it, but so much more. Child welfare, disability, mental health, air quality, things like that. I mean, we have focused a lot on health insurance, but should we also be thinking about these other areas that the department serves?
Yes. I think there's been a lot of attention drawn to mental health issues in the last few years. This is something that a lot of states are focused on in terms of better treatment for people, increased access, and I'm sure that those will continue to be concerns going forward. The type of public health infrastructure and services that our Mass Department of Public Health and the Center for Disease Control and Prevention on the federal level supports, you know, we've had the Zika virus, Ebola, other public health threats that are things that the federal government and states will continue to have to collaborate on in order to protect the public.
Mm. Now, help us understand sort of how the relationship works between someone who is in the position you once held as the Commonwealth's Secretary of Health and Human Services and the federal government. I mean, from the position of the Commonwealth Secretary, does it matter so much who the federal Secretary of Health and Human Services is, or does it matter more like what the overall take of the administration is?
Well, frankly, I think the most important thing is that we have certain things in statute that really define how various federal programs work. And Medicaid, you know, has a lot of law and regulation around it that guide states on about what they can do with Medicaid, what types of initiative they can take, what kind of innovations they can put in place. And I think, you know, most people in the position of secretary want to dig down deep and look at that and see what it shows, yeah, and then design what is going to serve their state's population and work with the federal government to achieve that. Right. And, you know, the Medicaid program is really more than 50 different demonstrations of that because of the flexibility, but with the sort of framework that's set by law, yeah, and regulation.
Well, last question then. Say you were the Commonwealth Secretary of Health and Human Services today. I mean, what would you be thinking about most? What would be worrying you the most?
Well, I think that getting the waiver implemented, demonstrating the impact of that is really important. I think a lot of people on both sides of the aisle, they say, are focused on demonstrating cost efficiency, value, and high quality, and making sure that people are getting the care they need. And I think using the waiver and the new waiver as it's been designed to achieve those goals is something that should be a focus.
Well, Judy Ann Bigby is the former Secretary of Health and Human Services for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. She held that post from 2007 to 2013. She's currently a senior fellow at Mathematica Policy Research in Cambridge. Judy Ann Bigby, thank you so much for coming in today.
My pleasure.
A little later in the hour, we'll talk transportation, but we'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Enron, WorldCom, Bernie Madoff, Galeon, these are all infamous names in some of the world's largest corporate crimes. We know what they did: corruption, fraud, theft, ethics violations. But do we really understand why? Well, Eugene Soltis is a professor at Harvard Business School, and he wanted to know the answer to that question. Turns out it's more complicated than we think. So he spoke to and corresponded directly with more than four dozen former top executives involved in some of the largest white-collar crimes, including Bernard Madoff and Alan Stanford, former Tyco CEO Dennis Kozlowski, Enron Chief Financial Officer Andy Fastow, ImClone CEO Samuel Waxall, and more and more and more and more. And what he found was very surprising. It's also the subject of his book, Why They Do It, Inside the Mind of the White Collar Criminal. And Eugene Soltis joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So First of all, I just have to ask, I mean, I have an intrinsic interest in this question, but what got you interested enough to correspond with these white-collar criminals who actually had, they're amongst those who had been caught? Why this question did you want answered?
So I think, like many people following the headlines, it's pretty rare that a week or two will go by and you don't see a headline of some former titan of industry doing something that's just totally shocking. And so one night, actually, this is 8 years ago, late at night, I was personally curious and actually just decided to write a couple of the people who I saw in the headlines. This is personal curiosity. I don't have my academic hat. This isn't as a researcher. So I wrote them, and a couple months later, I started to get responses. Some actually responding to the questions I initially asked, but others, like the former CEO of Tyco, said, I have time now. Come visit me. And I started to take them up on this opportunity to try to see the world a little bit more from their eyes.
Okay. So let's talk for a couple minutes in detail about one of the people that you corresponded with, because he was right there with what may be, you know, the grandfather of them all, the Enron scandal. Just to remind people, back in the year 2000, Enron was, what, the seventh largest firm in the United States? $100 billion market cap. In April 2001, MIT had named Enron the e-business of the year, but of course it collapsed entirely. 20,000 people lost their jobs. $60 billion in market value just vanished due to the corporate malfeasance that went on there. For those people who don't remember, wanted to excise it from their memory. So you spoke with Enron CFO or former CFO Andy Fastow.
Yes.
Now, first of all, what was he like?
He's smart, clever. He's oftentimes in the media, he was painted as this individual that was just behind the scenes helping the CEO and the chairman. But really, he's an extraordinary financier, except the challenge is he was actually trying to be too clever in many instances.
Yeah, I mean, so he served 5 years in prison for his role in the scandal, which included what? Hiding some of Enron's losses, the big losses, they were put off the balance sheet.
Off the balance sheet, right. Yeah. The idea was to really accelerate the good things that were occurring at Enron and feature those and figure out a way to essentially paper over, remove from the balance sheet, temporarily hide or delay the losses.
Okay, so when you talk to him then, I mean, that's just like sort of the tip of the iceberg of what went on in Enron. I mean, people remember they were like creating companies that didn't exist to move money around, things like that. But did Fastow give you any insight into why he did? I mean, he was the CFO. The buck should have stopped with him. I mean, why did he do it?
So Enron is an incredibly complex story of all the financial transactions. But Andy gave one example, which I think helps clarify. And he gives examples. Put ourselves in the position of being back in high school and asking our parents, can we go to a party at our friend's house on Friday night? Our parents say yes, under one condition, that you can't drink any alcohol at the party. You say, sure thing, mom, dad, and they give you their blessing, and you go to the party. And you arrive at the party, and a buddy of yours, as you enter, offers you a beer, and you decline politely, saying, my parents said I couldn't drink, and in deference, I'm not going to have a drink. Then an hour later, another friend comes up to you and says, you know what, I got something new. I actually have this new thing called a beer pill, and it has all the same wonderful effects of creating this intoxication, but you just eat it and swallow it. And so you sit there and think about it, and you're like, oh, I told my parents I wouldn't drink alcohol, but I said nothing about eating alcohol. And so you happily take the pill and get drunk with your friends. And technically, you feel like you're following the rules that you set by your parents. But as we can see, is if you were to drive home after that, you would have all the same detrimental and terrible impact of driving under the influence. Yeah. And that captures the mentality of Enron's executives. Technically trying to find really clever ways to, quote, follow the rules, but in the process, taking the principle and really just stomping on it.
Yeah, completely. I mean, as I hear you explain what the example that Fastow gave you, it sounds like a tortured rationalization for the fraud that they were perpetrating.
The challenge in speaking to many of these executives, these are brilliant, brilliant people in many instances. And the problem is you don't start thinking of these things as gray, ethical, moral dilemmas, but instead you think of them as problems. And you, being a clever person, need to try to figure out a solution to the problem, where in some instances there's a good reason why we have regulation. You're supposed to just not do it, yeah. Not find a way to ostensibly go around it in a new, clever way. But that's oftentimes what happens with really smart people.
Well, in the book, you relate that Andy Fastow told you, quote, "I was doing exactly what I was incentivized to do, and we wouldn't have gone through all this trouble if we just wanted to cheat. We were finding ways to get around the rules, but going through a complex process to find loopholes to allow us to do it." And then he says, "I cheated fair and square."
Yeah, I mean, there's a worrisome way of viewing it like that. But in many instances, where people view Enron's failures as being all kind of a charade, there was no underlying business. But that's not true. Most of the violations they ultimately prosecute the executives were really, really technical accounting violations. They ended up, and if you do, you know, thousands and thousands of deals and transactions, you're going to make things that are wrong. And that's ultimately how they prosecuted them. But they were trying to do it in a very clever way, seeing dozens of roadblocks and finding, along with their lawyers and accountants, finding very clever ways around that. And so he tends to see that as fair and square. We might also see that as just a perversion of leadership.
Well, so I wonder how much of this has to do with, the culture at Enron and perhaps in other parts of American industry, American corporate culture, because it sounds like, I mean, you know, the title of the other book and that movie was The Smartest Guys in the Room, right? Like, they all thought they were the smartest guys in the room, and so therefore, by virtue of just that, you know, was it easy for them to think, or maybe not even think, that what they were doing was unethical, criminal? Like, the idea just never even crossed their mind.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things that I learned from this project is we all actually do things that are wrong. For example, we all speed a little bit if you drive.
Speak for yourself.
Well, I'm going to follow you home.
I walk.
I'll walk. Okay. Most people speed. And then they rationalize it as saying everyone else is doing it. The speed limit's too low. I won't get a ticket if I go only 5 miles over the speed limit. But what's really critically stops people is they need to feel what they're doing is harmful. And if you feel what you're doing is harmful, you never even consider that as an option. But the problem is, in white-collar crime, people at the time, even really smart executives, don't feel what they're doing is harmful because they don't actually see the victims on the other side of the table. They're distant. They're abstract.
Well, so except ultimately, in the case of some of these, or many of these crimes, there are victims. I mean, just sticking with Enron here, we were talking about the 20,000 people who lost their jobs when Enron collapsed. Many of those people had their entire retirement savings also vested in Enron, which vanished. I mean, did Fastow ever talk to you about, does he have any feelings, any regrets, any remorse for the pain he caused those people? They are victims of what he did.
This is the part that it took me a while to really appreciate as I was doing these conversations, both with people at Enron, but more broadly, is really the lack of remorse. And that's because it's hard for people to actually identify how their particular action led to the devastation of all these people losing their 401k accounts, because they thought they were trying to build an amazing firm. Right? This is part of their image of themselves, is to create the world's greatest firm. And so, to the extent that people lost their accounts, retirement accounts, as the firm went down, they look at that as also a personal tragedy, that what they were building was also going downhill. But actually figuring out how your particular action, how moving this number around on a spreadsheet, how doing this particular deal ends up leading to someone not having a retirement account anymore, it's a very circuitous, and there's a lot of steps between that one action and someone losing their account. And it's hard for people to viscerally, I think, feel and realize that.
I have to say, I mean, this is so disappointing to me. Not you, but this realization, because these guys, I mean, just 2 minutes ago we were saying they thought themselves the smartest guys in the room. And if they're so smart, they can't figure out their role caused this? I mean, this sounds to me like a moral failing in them. They should be smart enough to realize that they destroyed the lives of thousands of people.
I agree.
Is there a moral failing here? Is that what we're getting at?
I agree. And this is, I think, a really difficult challenge of people that are in prominent positions, to actually, when you're controlling huge enterprises that whose your decisions impact thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, to actually remember in the end, kind of in that visceral feeling way, that your decisions today and tomorrow will affect all of them, each individual person, rather than this kind of amorphous mass. But most people end up, you can't resonate. An amorphous mass doesn't resonate with you.
So let's talk about then what you learned about how to get a sense of of checks and balances, for lack of a better term, in the process of doing business in America, especially at these high levels, where, you know, ideally, if those checks and balances are there, people are thinking about the potential ramifications of their decisions. I mean, what did you learn about how we can do that?
Well, I don't think anyone thinks, even when they're doing things quite blatantly wrong, if you're in these prominent positions, you never think that you're going to go to prison. And I think that's one of the huge challenges we face from a regulatory standpoint of trying to create deterrence. You think of, well, that's what those other guys do. That's what those bad guys do. That's not me. Even though the people I'm chatting with in my book, this is them. But even during the course of doing this, they don't see that themselves. We have these very powerful kind of internal mechanisms that protect our self-image. And so the trouble is, well, how do you get people, smart people, to take a step back from just seeing everything as a puzzle and actually see that a lot of the decision-making are actually significant moral and ethical dilemmas that have tremendous ramifications.
How do you do that? There's got to be structural ways, or I hope there are some structural ways to get that as part of the thinking.
One of the larger solutions that we think a lot about is corporate governance solutions, bringing in independent minds into the boardroom so to kind of spice it up, bring in different views and opinions. The problem is a lot of times, and Dennis Kozlowski, the former CEO, talked about this when he was convicted of embezzlement, is that he saw a lot of these independent directors really ultimately there to serve him. And so technically these people are independent, but like everyone, many times independent directors still have a vested personal interest of being on the board. It could be well-paying, could be prestigious. So are they going to push back in the way to actually create that independence? But ideally, that's what we want. We want to make the world a little bit more like the classroom, where these decisions during corporate training or business school class are not oftentimes that difficult to resolve. They're oftentimes looks pretty black and white, like something like insider trading. But in the boardroom, these things look a lot more muddled. And it's like, why is that the case? Well, you don't have people deeply reflecting on it. You don't have different points of view being brought in. And probably most critically, you don't have anyone pointing out what the ethical dilemma is initially. We hand it to people, students in the classroom. Executives don't always get that clarity handed to them.
No one's pointing it out to them. This could be ethically problematic. I mean, shouldn't they know? Because you there's an example you have in the book of a CEO of one, you know, whenever there's something that sort of tingled his spidey sense and he wondered if it was right or wrong, he would actually go to a friend who was independent and outside of the company, a lawyer friend, and say, you know, check this out. Is this okay?
Exactly. So this is the case of Ben Horowitz, who wanted an outside view. And in that regard, that's what protected him, going outside the firm, getting a different point of view outside this small culture within Silicon Valley. And ultimately, it's not because, and as he admits, it's not because he had a better moral compass or was more authentic or better values, but simply he knew when to seek advice.
Yeah.
The problem is many times when people seek advice, they go to their very high-priced, top-notch attorney, rather than the attorney saying, whoa, Eugene, this is not what you value as an individual or firm. What they do is sit down and say, let me come back to you in 3 days and find a way to ostensibly do what you just described as illegal, but in a way that technically is okay. And so that's the problem, is a lot of the institutions and checks and balances actually support what the executive is doing rather than actually providing that pushback.
So let me ask you one last question, because we're almost out of time here. I mean, you are a professor at Harvard Business School, and many, many people point to, you know, places like HBS says, this is where those muscles and habits for doing that self-checking, that soul-searching, that the building the structures that make America's future business leaders have ethical considerations as part of how they do business, it ought to be crafted and honed in at Harvard Business School. I mean, you see some logic behind that there, right?
And I think we do that. The trouble is that the time they spend thinking about this, it's ultimately 2 years, or in an ethics class, it's 40 or 50 hours in the classroom. They then go, let's say they go work at a bank. That's equivalent to their first 3 days of work. So whatever culture they're now in within their bank or whatever firm they go work overwhelms whatever they've honed very, very quickly. And so this is where one of the challenges that we face is how do you get back that spirit? How do you rekindle those things that you might have been thinking when you had the time to step back and think? And
one of the challenges. Make it more than one class, or have it be a part of every class taken at a business school.
Well, I would like every year or two when people come back for the reunions, if they took a day That might be a way.
That's a great idea. Well, Eugene Soltis is a Harvard Business School professor. His new book is absolutely fascinating. It's called Why They Do It, Inside the Mind of the White Collar Criminal. Professor Soltis, thank you so much for coming in today. It was really, really interesting to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's continue now with our exploration of President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet and the impact his appointments could have on Massachusetts. On Tuesday, Trump nominated Elaine Chao as Secretary of Transportation. Chao served as the Secretary of Labor under President George W. Bush. She's also married to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. She's also an experienced Washington insider. McConnell has said he will not recuse himself from his wife's cabinet confirmation. Process. Now, if Chao is confirmed, she'll be leading on an issue that Donald Trump made central to his campaign, rebuilding the nation's infrastructure. Here's Trump in his victory speech earlier this month in New York.
We are going to fix our inner cities and rebuild our highways, bridges, tunnels, airports, schools, hospitals. We're going to rebuild our infrastructure, which will become, by the way, second to none. And we will put millions of our people to work as we rebuild it.
And of course, that was Donald Trump last month. I should say how quickly time flies. Trump also promised a $1 trillion investment in American infrastructure over the next 10 years. So for more on what all this might mean for Massachusetts, we're joined by Richard Davey. He served as Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation from 2011 to 2014. He was also general manager of the MBTA before that. He's now working at the transportation company TransDev. Richard Davey, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Megan. Appreciate it.
All right, so I'm going to ask you kind of a similar set of context questions here as I did of Judy Ann Bigby earlier this hour.
Yes, it's like old home week here for former cabinet secretaries
in Massachusetts. This is our opportunity to really understand how important the relationships are between cabinet-level folks in the state and in Washington. So tell me, as Secretary of Transportation, when you were that, how important was it, whoever was the federal transportation secretary?
Yeah, I mean, for transportation, it was really important. And so, like Judy said, for a lot of federal programs, states just have formula funds, and there's really not a lot of discretion. But in President Obama's time, there was a lot of discretionary grants that were available to states and projects. And so, for Massachusetts, it was really important for both the governor and the president to have a good relationship with the Senate, with our members of Congress. But also, I personally was able to develop a pretty good relationship with Secretary Fox in my couple of years serving as Transportation Secretary. Secretary Fox is the current U.S. Transportation Secretary. And when you're able to pick up the phone and talk about the Green Line extension to Somerville or what Ruggles T Station is and not have to give the person context, they know what it means, that's really, really important. So I think for discretionary purposes, I assume the Baker administration will probably reach out to Secretary Chao at some point and want to get some of the state's key projects on her radar.
Discretionary purposes. So tell us more about are these those grants that you're talking about?
Yeah. So everything from redoing some bridges, which we were successful in getting the stimulus package that was delivered by President Obama in 2009, there was a lot of transportation infrastructure discretionary grants. So those were selected with a list of criteria. But still, at the end of the day, the secretary and his team have discretion about awarding those. So I mentioned Ruggles Station. That was an award we received toward the end of the Patrick administration that the Baker administration is executing on now, which is going to expand and improve that station. That, if we didn't have a good relationship with the administration, probably wouldn't have been awarded.
Now, last week we spoke with our current Transportation Secretary of the Commonwealth, Stephanie Pollack, and we asked her about the Green Line extension and whether or not a new Trump administration could affect the funding plans for that. She said she didn't think so at this point in time. But is that the kind of project that a funding stream could change all of a sudden, or if the current administration has agreed to it, it's set in stone?
No, it's not set in stone, but I tend to agree with Secretary Pollack. I think it's unlikely that the Trump administration would somehow repurpose that. The money is coming from a particular program that is really only for new transit projects. So even if the Trump administration decides that they're really focused on airports, for example, they could not take by statute, the Green Line extension money and put it toward an airport project, for example. So I think going forward, however, with new budgets coming forward, with the new administration coming in, I think there probably will be some changes, given the clues we've seen over the last few weeks about his infrastructure plans.
Okay, so tell me more about that. If you were Transportation Secretary right now for Massachusetts, mm-hmm. what would be the questions that you'd have, or what things would you be looking for in terms of signals from, let's just say, Elaine Chao gets confirmed?
Sure. Yeah. Well, first, for the Secretary-designate Elaine Chao, I mean, I think she is a great choice, both politically and policy-wise. Obviously, a shrewd political choice, as you mentioned in the intro. Her husband is the majority leader in the Senate. So if an infrastructure bill is going to be important, though, certainly the relationships in the House and the Senate will be important. Obviously, she's married to the majority leader. That's important. I also think, two, the other signals that you're looking for, she was a deputy secretary for the first President Bush at a time, by the way, when the federal gas tax, the last time it was raised. Now,
1993.
It's when it was implemented, but
implemented,
it was—
and then raised in 2000.
So the last time federal gas tax was raised was 1993. Massachusetts has raised the gas tax, its state gas tax, subsequent.
That's right.
But Secretary Chao, give her credit. She was part of a Republican team, by the way, that looked at raising more revenue. Again, she's not the president. It will be up to the president to make that decision. But clearly, there's been bills filed by both Democrats and Republicans the last few years about getting more money into the system. If you look at the chart, we spend about $50 billion a year nationally on transportation, and the federal gas tax only brings in about $35 billion. So the idea when it was established was it would pay for itself, and it's not doing that now. It's driving our debt up and having a serious challenge on states' abilities to invest in their transportation systems.
Okay, so barring any new revenue stream or innovative source of revenue, I'm not seeing anything in the next administration that is going to change that challenge.
So as I understand, what they've proposed is this infrastructure bill, which would repatriate some dollars up to $167 billion that would then leverage another almost $800. So you get to about $1 trillion over a 10-year period, as you teased out. The challenge with that, and that's good news, but the challenge with that is that's not going to be an all-in-one encompassing savior for transportation. Here's why. Because for those private investors, they're going to want a return, and
right.
So you're going to need to find projects that have a revenue stream attached to it. So airports, that would be a good investment. Toll roads, sure, but buying new red line cars in the MBTA, that's not happening under this program. It just is not going to happen because this government is subsidizing that. The MBTA doesn't make money on it, so you have to be looking for new projects that generate funds. Water is probably another. The grid are other kind of projects that are likely to happen under this bill. But you worry that transit and upgrading current bridges and roads probably aren't going to fall into that infrastructure plan. It's probably going to be new, not old.
Interesting. Although, a lot of those new, quote-unquote, new projects that you talked about are desperately needed. I mean, they're all...
Sure.
President-elect Trump was absolutely right about the state of a lot of the nation's airports.
No doubt. No doubt.
But you said, just to be clear, mm-hmm. You talked about the repatriating some of those funds, but the Trump plan would have them repatriated at a much lower tax rate, like 10%, I think, versus 35%.
That's right. And in addition, giving a tax break to those who invest in these public infrastructure projects, with the idea of being revenue neutral, and it being revenue neutral because the idea from his economic team is that the taxes that then would be paid by construction firms that are hired, or the income of the workers hired, would thus pay for the tax break. So, I think the jury is still out on whether it really pays for itself. I'm not sure in my experience I've ever seen a tax scheme that has, quote, paid for itself. With that said, I think it's an important, he's also talked about a potential infrastructure bank, which was also part of the Democrats' platform as well, something that's been talked about here.
Yeah.
So I think there are pieces of the incoming administration's plan that can be helpful to Massachusetts, but people should know, at least in my opinion, is not a silver bullet to take care of all the needs for our state or, frankly, for the rest of the nation.
Okay, so you mentioned red line trains, for example, is one. I mean, what are some of the other examples where you don't necessarily see the Trump plan as being of direct or immediate assistance to what we need here?
Yeah, sure. And so I know that the team is currently grappling with not only an annual budget deficit. I mean, that will not be necessarily helped with the infrastructure plan that the Trump folks have. But you know, as the T continues to make investments in state of good repair, they're still thinking about things like upgrading power systems on the Green Line that allows you to run 3-car trains, 4-car trains to reduce crowding. You know, those kinds of projects are not going to be helped by this infrastructure plan. If you built a third bridge over the Cape Cod Canal mm-hmm. and tolled that, that's probably a project that would be funded under the Trump plan. If there was a major modernization over at Logan Airport, anyone who's flown through LaGuardia lately knows that's undergoing something like this, and it needs to. As you said, the nation's airports are in desperate need of investment. Those are likely because we all, when we buy a plane ticket, we all pay a $4.50 charge to the airport to fund projects. So those are the kinds of things that are likely to be funded. But again, for the, you know, Massachusetts at the end of the day is not building a lot of new things that are right. that are generating revenue. So I think for an urban center like the Boston area, even for the state where you're not building new, I think, you know, at least the current proposal that's been put out by the Trump administration, we're probably not going to be a big beneficiary of.
Huh. Well, so if we got a minute to go here, Richard mm-hmm. Davey, let me just ask you, is this who knows if Congress will approve any of this, right?
Sure.
That's there's like a huge question mark here. But let's take this as a moment for a potential change moment in mm-hmm. terms of big push for transportation and infrastructure investment. Is there an opportunity here to think, you know, even further into the future, not just like
sure.
new airports or more lanes on highways?
Sure. I candidly, I think this is a place where the current administration and the incoming administration are going to be consistent, which is on autonomous vehicles, right? So the Obama administration has taken a very, I would say, light touch in terms of regulation, allowing some of the really innovative stuff going on in the U.S. to happen. I expect the Trump administration will do the same. And to your point, you know, if we move to an autonomous vehicle-centric society in the next 10 or 20 years, query whether you need more lanes and bridges, because there will be significant efficiencies in our transportation system. So, you know, that'd be another question that we should ultimately ask is the investments made by the Trump administration, they should be the right investments as well.
Well, Richard Davey served as Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation from 2011 to 2014. He was also general manager at the MBTA back in 2010. He's now working at the transportation company TransDev. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, finally today, I want to introduce you to one of the most beloved librarians in the entire country. Her name is Andrea Bernard. She's the library director at Tyler Memorial Library in Charlemont, Massachusetts, in the Berkshires. And she is one of just 10 winners of the 2016 I Love My Librarian Award. It's given in recognition for exceptional accomplishment and service to the community. The annual honor and $5,000 award are given by the Carnegie Corporation and the American Library Association. Andrea Bernard joins us now from New York, where she accepted the I Love My Librarian Award just last night. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, first of all, I should tell you, congratulations. How does it feel to be recognized as one of the most creative and best librarians in America?
It was really overwhelming and really wonderful at the same time. I feel really honored.
Well, you are a gift to the community that you work in. Can you tell me a little bit about the library in Charlemont?
Sure. So the library serves two communities, actually, Charlemont and Hawley, which is a neighboring town. And between the two communities, we serve about 1,300 people living in the foothills of the Berkshire Mountains in western Massachusetts.
And tell me more about what goes on in the library.
Well, so we have all of the usual library resources, books and audiobooks and magazines and DVDs for people to check out of the library. And we've started several new programming opportunities to reach out to the community and invite people to come into the library and see the library as a community center. So I run a series of programs in the winter that focus on connecting the community to local experts in various arts. And so people come in and try out various activities. And
so, Andrea, can I just jump in here for a second?
Because
you're doing something which is so delightful and I think so telling about how committed you are to the community. You're underselling yourself, okay? Because you're only one of 10 librarians in the country this year to receive the honor. And the reason why you received the honor is you're being recognized for your exceptional contributions to the community.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing here that one of those things is, for example, you established something called Tyler Tech. It's a summer program for local school kids. What is that?
So Tyler Tech is a program for kids to have access to STEAM activities. And STEAM stands for science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. And so this was a program for school-aged children to experience science and experience art together and really have an opportunity to explore and grow. And so, for example, we had a program at the library for 3D printing this past summer, and kids had the opportunity to come in and use a CAD program and have their program sent to the printer and have objects printed. And for many of them, it was the first time that they had seen the printer and the first time that they had used that kind of software. So it was very exciting for them and also for me. I loved it.
It makes me want to come out there and visit you guys, to be perfectly honest. You also recognize a very profound and basic need for a lot of library users in your neck of the woods, and that was that they didn't actually have any access to high-speed internet at home.
That's right. Many people in Western Massachusetts don't have access to high-speed internet and also don't have access to TV as a result. So the library becomes a great place to get news, but also to access their own Gmail accounts or email generally. So it's a great way for people to be able to stay in touch with family, with friends, with neighbors, to access all of the news that they need to keep in touch with events happening both here in the U.S. and globally. So it's a really important way for people to be connected.
So, Andrea, let me ask you, did you grow up in the Berkshires?
I did not. I grew up in Brooklyn for the first half of my childhood and then in a small town in upstate New York the second half. Oh, and then I spent about close to 30 years living in Boston before moving out to Western Mass.
Well, at what point in time or what was the moment in your life when you said, aha, what I want to be when I grow up is a librarian in a small town in Western Mass?
So that's a really interesting question because I was working as a child development specialist with children and families who were exposed to violence and who were at risk for developmental delays. And I had done that for my whole adult career. And I knew I needed a change. I wanted to continue doing public service. And I started thinking about all of the ways that libraries had been important to me in my life. And it felt like such a good natural fit. Being in a public library as a solo librarian just suits my personality. I like to be involved in everything. And if I worked in a larger library, I'm sure I would love that too, but I would probably be doing a very specific, defined job description. And in this small public library, as a solo librarian, I get to do everything. And I love that.
Well, you mentioned that there were ways in which libraries were important to you growing up. Like, how were they important to you?
So my librarian, when I was growing up, was just a really special person. She let me wander through the library, through the kids' room, and find my own way when I wanted to do that. But she also steered a course for me and really exposed me to new books and new ideas when she knew I was ready for that. And I especially remember how she helped me move from the kids' room to the adult room when I was a teenager and ready to make a transition to more mature reading. And so that was really important to me. And she was really important to me, and I never forgot her.
You know, I can guarantee you, Andrea, that right now in Charlemont, there are young people who feel exactly the same way about you as you do about that librarian.
Oh, thank you so much. That means a lot.
Well, Andrea Bernard is library director at Tyler Memorial Library in Charlemont, Massachusetts. She's one of 10 librarians across America who have been awarded the I Love My Librarian Award. It's given out by the Carnegie Corporation and the American Library Association. Andrea, congratulations again, and thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me today.
I'm just going to add, we should celebrate all our local librarians. A great crew, one and all. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek, with help from Caitlin O'Keefe and Cassandra Sunt. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. That's it for today. Do join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.